Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. This show is also podcasting on the internet at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. All this week, we are rebroadcasting the opera series that ran here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe earlier this year. This week, the Santa Fe Opera is presenting all five of the season's operas, so each day this week, we're playing the corresponding program. For more information and tickets, call the Santa Fe Opera box office at 986-5900 or find them online at santafeopera.org. I'd like now to welcome Desiree Mays, the author of Opera Unveiled. It's the book that comes out every year to accompany the Santa Fe Opera. Welcome, Desiree.
Hello, Mary Charlotte.
And so we are now sort of going back in time to talk about Baroque opera. Mm-hmm. The Baroque opera of this season is called Platée by Jean-Philippe Rameau.
It is, and this is the earliest we may ever go, actually, in opera. Opera started in 1597 with Daphne. The early composers loved Greek myth, and that was the source of all of their operas. And this piece appeared in 1745. It's a French piece. Everything about it is French. It's a comedy. It's actually a send-up. This is not a straight dramatic opera. It's a really fun piece, but it is in the Baroque style. And I know many people ask me, what is Baroque? So rather than giving you a complete history lesson, I'm going to just give you a few high points of what the Baroque style is and what to listen for. And then we'll hear a couple of examples that will give you a sort of a sense of how it sounds. The Baroque style grew out of the Renaissance, and that was a time when there was a lot of polyphony and counterpoint. The Baroque style uses sort of long lines of melody and song, and it has much stronger rhythms. It's always accompanied by what's called a basso continuo. That means that there's a sung line and underneath a bass instrument, a stringed instrument or a harpsichord will sort of give accompaniment. At this time, the words were still important in what we call now recitative, which is the conversational, the chatty bits of opera that get you from aria to aria where a character expresses how they're feeling. There was a lot of this recitative, and we'll hear some of that in some of the examples. The text was still important. More important than the music. And the early, very beginnings of opera with the Camerata, this was a group of men in Florence who developed the early operas. The words, the text was to be always heard. The music would simply accompany. And things are beginning to change now. The instrumentation is becoming a little bit more important. Vocal soloists had to be better singers. They had to be able to express an emotion better, not just present a line. So there were many developments that the form of oratorio and cantata comes into being around about this time. There's an awful lot of repeats in these. So if you're watching, listening to any Baroque opera or following it on a libretto or the subtitles, you'll see one line that goes on seemingly forever because it's repeated over and over again.
That's true. If you miss something on the subtitles, you haven't really missed it because the thought keeps coming back.
It'll keep coming back.
Whereas in a romantic or classical opera, you might really miss some of the action.
Yeah, for instance, with La Bohème, nobody repeats anything. They'll sing to one another, and the conversation will be sung through, and it'll continue. Not here. That's one of the aspects to look for, that there's a lot of repeats, ritornello. There's also the emergence of solo instruments. The orchestra begins to be heard. The music now takes a much bigger role. It's not all about the singing voice and the text. Solo instruments begin to have their own little moments, and you'll hear some of that in Platée.
I think that's something that's we haven't talked about yet, which is there's so much focus on the opera singers. What about the orchestra?
The music?
Yeah.
Well, I think last week was a good example of that with Daphne. Richard Strauss was a symphonic orchestral composer known for his great tone poems. And there are whole sections of Daphne that are just purely orchestral, including the incredible ending. I mean, this is an opera that ends without singing. It ends with music. And music in so many ways will speak to us so much more deeply and meaningfully than the word. That's why I think one of opera's greatest strengths is it's the music that will really give us, tell us what's happening. So in these early days, I mean, it's a great form to parody too, and that's what happens in this opera, in Platé. Jean-Philippe Rameau, who is the composer, was reared in the school of Lully. Lully was the composer of the French court, and he was the French composer who developed the Baroque style of the time that was very structured. There was no comedy. He had no sense of humor, this man, whereas Rameau did.
Rameau, as we shall see.
I mean, this is a ridiculous opera for what it does. It takes the Baroque style, and he was a master of this. He actually wrote books on harmonics. He was known, first of all, for his writings, his treatise on theory and music harmony, all of which advanced the style of Lully, which the French didn't actually like at the time. They were pretty upset. I mean, they liked their opera as it was, and they were upset about the influence of the Italians from across the border.
It's sort of like Santa Fe's not wanting anything to be different than it was
five years ago. But, you know, things change, and Italian opera became the form of opera not long after. Though, in a way, it was an unnecessary argument, because the Italians were moving more toward aria and comic, you know, comedy, opera buffa, as it became, whereas the French were happy to stay with more tragedy lyrique. This is a comedy lyrique that is actually parodying the tragedy, as you'll see. There's some wonderful moments, things that Platé does with the style. There are, for instance, that the rhythm had been fairly set. With Platé, he changes the rhythm. He uses sound effects for comic effect. So you'll hear, you know, frogs and cuckoos, the braying of a donkey. You'll hear all of this in the score. He had, as a sort of, when he first arrived in Paris, he didn't have much work, so he played in the foire theatres. These were the fair theatres that grew out of the Commedia dell'arte. They were burlesque theatres. So there's an awful lot of burlesque in this opera. For this he was, you know, much criticised, but the basis of the opera was, it was very simple, it was direct. There was a lot of ornamentation, so in some of these repeats, the first line will be sung fairly straight, and then as it develops, it gets very embellished and ornamented. So that means the singer takes off on trills and runs and all sorts of wild stuff.
And usually, are those improvised?
In those days, they were. Yes, this was something that Mozart tried to put a stop to by writing in the cadenzas, as they're called, the sections where the singer can improvise. What they did, I mean, it was outrageous in those days. A singer would have a certain cadenza that he or she was very famous for, and they would just stick that in to the current opera of the day, regardless of whether it was a tragedy or a comedy. When it came their time to sing and show off their beautiful voice, they took off and did the same cadenza, which must have been crazy. So this happens, and there's again a parody of this, and we'll talk about that when we get down to it. But maybe the first piece of music we could play, Mary Charlotte, is to give you an example of the Baroque style. Let's hear something from the prologue of Platé. It's where Thespis, who is the god of comedy, is singing with the chorus. So perhaps we could hear that first.
Okay.
So that's a great example of the Baroque style.
Mm. And let's take it now to the next step and see what Rameau does with this when he takes the style and he includes the sound of frogs and cuckoos. Platé is a frog, and we'll get to that in a minute, but you'd never think you're going to hear the wah, wah, wah of a frog in a musical score, especially something that's supposed to be Baroque. And lo and behold, there's frogs. And later on, they're out in the nature and the country, and you'll hear the cuckoo sound. So let's just hear a bit of that. A very little brief, quick cut of that. This is I'm playing from a DVD, actually. There's a great one out there of this opera. It's very hard to find a recording of this. You have to be in France to get one.
Is that right? It's not one of the better known operas.
This was an opera that was very popular when it first came out in 1745, but then it sort of dropped out of circulation until the 20th century, mainly because of the great Platés who have appeared and sung the roles. So there is a French recording that's not available in this country, but people really should, and I do encourage this, get the DVD of Platé. The opera shop I know does have that, and it's a fun piece to own. You'll watch it many times.
It is incredible. The visual, the costumes, the whole spectacle of it, and that particular production, and we'll talk about that in a moment, it with the modern costumes and so on, is
right,
really something.
Right, and our production here at the Santa Fe Opera will be quite similar to the one that you saw from Paris with the same director, actually, Laurent Pilly. Well, maybe talk a little bit about what on earth is Platé about. Platé is it's a Baroque opera with a prologue and three acts. And in the prologue, the gods and the people on the hillsides of a Greek mountain, Mount Cithaeron, are discussing the fact that Jupiter is pretty upset because his wife Juno is wildly jealous. Totally justifiably. I mean, Jupiter was a very promiscuous god, as we all know. So she's creating all these storms, she's venting her anger, and things are really unhappy, and they want to do something about this. So this little group come up with a plan that Jupiter will come to Earth, he will fall in love with some lesser being, and then Juno will be tipped off, she'll come to the wedding and she'll see what's going on, and the whole thing will go away. Now what happens is that...
Now wait a minute, he will fall in love or pretend to
he
fall
will
in
pretend
love
to fall, yeah, he
with
will
a lesser being whom
right.
we will meet in a moment.
That's right.
And when Juno finds out that it's not for real, she will say, oh, I should never have been jealous.
Mistrusted you, exactly. So Cithaeron suggests...
That's quite a deceptive little trick to play on your wife.
Oh, it's black humor. I mean, this is theater of the absurd with a capital A. It really is, though that didn't exist at the time. So Cithaeron suggests that he knows of someone. He said there's Platé. She's a nymph, a frog who lives in the marsh, and she thinks...
Now, a marsh nymph, that's something I never heard of before this opera.
No, nor did I. I mean, it seems to be a contradiction in terms.
Yeah, a marsh nymph who's a frog.
Yes, exactly, and it's her land. She owns, she has all these subjects. She's sort of the queen of the frog marshes. So she is proposed as a possible person, and Jupiter comes down, and he comes in a cloud of lightning and thunder, and he tells her he loves her, and she's completely speechless and cannot respond. And he says, do I not please you? And finally she says, yes, of course. And then he says, well, we're going to have a marriage, but beforehand there'll be a divertissement, which is something the French really loved. This is what they went to these spectacles for, the divertissement and the dance, and there's a whole series of dances, and then finally they come to the wedding ceremony, and Jupiter takes the hand of Platé, who's now totally confused. She doesn't really know what's going on.
But she does feel that the god is in love with her.
Oh, she believes it's going to happen. She does. And you'll hear in some of these sections how that whole thing is set up. And then Jupiter says to her, I swear he's going to marry her. And he repeats it a number of times, looking over his shoulder at Mercury, his partner in crime in all this, exactly, saying, where's Juno? Because Mercury was to tip off Juno the wedding is about to happen. So finally, Juno appears in a raging storm. She believes that Jupiter is disloyal to her. He's unfaithful. He's going to marry this person. And she goes striding over to Plate, who's wearing a veil, of course, for the wedding ceremony. She tears the veil off, and she sees the face of the stricken frog. And she bursts into laughter, and she said, this was an incredible joke. And Jupiter says to her, how could you doubt that I didn't love you? And the two of them wander off up back to the heavens, and Plate is left devastated. Then the crowd, the singers and the dancers, pull her back on stage, and they really make fun of her. It's a very tragic moment at the end. And she blames Cithaeron for this terrible affront to her as a woman.
So Jupiter deceives his wife, and he deceives this frog nymph.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And the punchline of the whole thing is that the frog is played by a man that's written for a tenor. So the whole thing is basically a big drag show.
Well, that's a, you could call it that, I suppose. They call it a travesty role, I think the reason for this was to alleviate some of the trauma of the real story, which is a tragic little story. I mean, this is a terrible case of deception. She's totally abandoned. The gods didn't care. And maybe Rameau himself was having a little dig at the French aristocracy here in terms of how the aristocracy treated their subjects, their servants, their people. I think there was some of that going on in this opera. There's a parody within the parody happening. But the whole thing is alleviated, I think, by the fact that Plate is sung by a man, not by a woman. So it becomes a comedic role. It would be much harder to make to use it as a throwaway comedy if Plate was sung by a woman and a woman was being treated so badly. So the role is sung by a man with a special voice. It's called a haute contre voice, which is a high tenor voice that the French loved in these Baroque roles. It was not a countertenor. They don't make that shift up into that higher range, but it's a high and a light and a very beautiful sound. But Plate has to be much more than a great tenor. This has got to be an incredible character actor to be able to play this. And I think this is what has brought the opera back in the 20th century, because there have been some incredible singers, and we are fortunate enough to have the greatest one of those. Jean-Paul Fouchecourt will be singing our Plate. He sang it in Paris and in London and at New York City Opera, a number of different places. So we're thrilled that he will be singing our Plate here. He's not actually on this recording. The recording we hear here is with Gilles Ragon. But maybe we could play a little of his entrance, so you'll get a sense of what this Plate frog nymph sounds like. This is an opera you have to see, too. I mean, it's a very visual piece.
So the part we're about to hear, set up for us what the action is.
Well, at this point, Plate has been told that Juno is very angry and she's going to flood the earth with storms. And actually, as a frog from the marsh, she's quite happy about that. They like the water. So here she sings, this is a little hymn, she sings to her nymphs, to the nymphs of my court. This is from the libretto. Leave, O ye nymphs, abandon your deepest dwellings. A torrent of celestial waves is about to flood our setting. And you, Juno, weep, do your worst. Pour water over my domain. Leave, ye nymphs, abandon your dwellings. A torrent of celestial waves is about to flood our setting. And these are the words he sings in French, of course. Adorant des célestes ondes, et près d'inonder ces climats, et près d'inonder ces climats. Quittez vos demeures profondes, quittez vos demeures profondes. Adorant des célestes zones, et près d'inondés, c'est clair. Adorant des célestes zones, et près d'inondés.
We're listening to music from the opera Platé from the Santa Fe Opera season. We're talking to Desiree Mays, author of Opera Unveiled. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and we're talking about the Santa Fe Opera and specifically the opera Platé.
I thought in choosing selections for this opera, to give people a sense of what it's about, there is one sort of straight, very beautiful piece that is short we might listen to. It's a lament, and in these early operas, laments were a very important part. Most people know the beautiful lament of Orpheus when he loses Eurydice from the very early opera. So I'm going to play a lament today, and this is to demonstrate a certain point. At the time of the Baroque, this was called the doctrine of the affections. I wonder if it's still really applies. It means that there was a proposition that music is capable of arousing a variety of specific emotions within the listener. I think we all agree with that. At the center of the doctrine was the belief that by making use of the proper musical standard or procedure, the composer could create a piece of music capable of producing a particular involuntary emotional response in the audience. But if, as musicians of the Baroque believed, music was the physical embodiment of feelings, moods, and emotions, then one musical idea should be linked to one emotion. So this is the doctrine of the affectations, which was a central belief of the Baroque period, where when they came to what we call an aria today, one long song, one emotion would be developed. And they believed that they understood the musical structure that was necessary in order to evoke that feeling in the listener. That's a wonderful idea. I think it does work. I mean, we'll see in this lament, if it makes you feel sad, if it makes you feel that it is a lament, that something is lost. And here it really doesn't matter what or who has lost what. It's about the emotion itself. Now, this changes later in opera where you're involved with character and you have to relate first to the character and how they're feeling. So you're listening to their love or their hate or their passion or need for revenge.
But this is about if you hear the music, even without words, even without knowing what the action is, just the qualities of the music
will
make you sad.
Will make you sad.
Ladies and gentlemen, try this out at home in just a moment.
Try it right now. Let's listen to the lament of Clarina. There's one other thing to listen for here, too. This is, she is accompanied just by the harpsichord. And the instrument you hear is the clarinet, which you would not expect in this early period of opera. But in fact, Rameau, the composer, was responsible for bringing horns and the clarinet into the opera orchestra at the time. So there's a couple of things to listen for there. First of all, to just let the music speak to you and see how it makes you feel. Is it for you a lament?
Oh,
And that was the Lament from the opera Platé. And our listeners at home can see if they felt that sadness that was supposed to be embodied in the music.
Did you?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, it has that minor sort of off-balance sound. It's slow, it's drawn out. And
it'd be interesting to bring things like that into the schools and have a bunch of fourth graders say, okay, you don't know what this is about. What do you think it's about?
We do that. That's part of the process. Yeah, you can play bits of music and then have them tell you how it makes them feel. So and kids are very perceptive. Very often they have no problem. They'll get right to it. We come to opera with so many preconceived ideas of what it is or should be. And I think we lose that ability to be so open to opera the way kids are. It's fascinating at the Santa Fe Opera. We open our dress rehearsals to families, to children, and the Native American children have no problem whatsoever relating to opera because they're very familiar with dance and song, with masks and make-believe and pretend and different sounds. They relate immediately without question, much more so than our kids who sometimes wonder what it's all about. So it's interesting.
We're talking to Desiree Mays. She is the author of the book Opera Unveiled, which accompanies the Santa Fe Opera every year. There's information and stories about each of the five Santa Fe operas, and the book can be procured at any local bookstore or at the Santa Fe Opera. Now, an opera like Platé, it was first performed in 1745. For whom was an opera like this written? For whom was it performed? And what was the context?
In the early days, from the very beginning, the opera was of the aristocracy. These were Florentine noblemen who first performed the first operas in their palaces, as Mozart did, actually. Still, most of his performances were in these beautiful salons of these extraordinary palaces. And royalty, especially French royalty at this time, we're talking about Louis XIV and Louis XV, spent vast amounts of money on entertainment. The entertainment came in three parts. There was music and ballet. Dance was very important. And spectacle. They did extraordinary things with staging. In this opera, for instance, each time Jupiter and Mercury ascend or descend from heaven, they really did. I mean, they would literally take off. And people went because they loved the spectacle.
So they would have systems of strings and pulleys.
Extraordinary. Yeah, I mean, their engineering techniques in those days were quite amazing. I mean, they would transform gardens and salons and palaces into opera sets, and people went for this. They were very long. They went on for hours on end, and meals would be served in the intermissions. So this, at the beginning, was strictly for the royalty. It was in royal palaces, royal houses. The commissions came from the royalty, the nobility. But at this point, it's interesting. In 1745, when this opera actually did premiere at Versailles in front of Louis XV and the court, where it was a great success, we're at a time in history where things are beginning to change. The royalty, we're coming towards the end of royal absolutism. It's only not too far ahead of the French Revolution. Things are beginning to change, as is opera. Opera now was being also presented in a theater, French theater called the Académie Royale de Musique, that actually has become the Paris Opera, or the Garnier as we know it today. I mean, you can go to the Paris Opera, that's where everybody goes to opera. So we're at a transition time with Platé, where first of all it was presented before Louis XV and the court, and something like 4 years after that premiere, it was presented at the theater, the Académie, before the public. So this is now a time when things also begin to change, the plots begin to change, because it's not the nobility writing about themselves for themselves and glorifying themselves, which all these early operas did. They begin to start using real people, real situations, as a cultured middle class begins to rise and as history changes in Europe. So it's a fascinating time in history. The way this opera actually was commissioned is a sort of an intriguing little story. The commission came from the court, the French court, for the French Dauphin's wedding to the Spanish Princess Maria Theresa. And this is not to be confused with the great Habsburg Maria Theresa. This was a small Spanish princess who apparently was quite ugly, sadly. And it was feared that Platé, the ugly frog who thinks she's going to marry Jupiter, could be seen as a parody of the royal couple whom Roma was supposed to honor. But as it turned out, the whole coincidence passed unobserved. Nobody said anything about it. In fact, a few months after the wedding, Rameau was given two royal pensions and the title of composer in the King's Chamber of Music. And he did spend most of the rest of his life, his composing life, at the court of Versailles. So that's how this particular opera was commissioned and paid for.
And everybody loved it.
And everybody loved it at the time. Nobody really noticed. And I think the hidden agenda, perhaps from Rameau's point of view, was a criticism of the way the gods, the royalties, treated the people. But they never noticed it, it seemed, just as well, or he'd have been exiled, or worse, it would have been the end of him.
One of the features of this opera that we see in the DVD and that we will see in the Santa Fe Opera production is that there is a great deal of dance. Dance plays a huge role.
Yeah, and that's a very French thing. The French always prefer dance to opera. I wonder if that's still true. I mean, Wagner ran into this problem because when he presented Tannhäuser in Paris, the entire jockey club never appeared before the second act, and he put the ballet in the first act, and the entire opera died. I mean, Tannhäuser was a terrible disaster in Paris because the dance was not in the right place. Even that late, the French wanted dance. So in this early Baroque, the dance was very important. So when Jupiter says to Platé whom he's going to marry, we have to hold everything back, time stands still for divertissement. Now, this would be a whole series of dances, of court dances, again, which Rameau parodies. So when the dancers come out in this production, it's hysterical. They parody the chaconne. There's a chaconne in here. This is a dance that goes on endlessly. Now, those were quite long dances, but in this, it's endless, as Platé is waiting for them to get on with the wedding ceremony. That never happens. There's a wonderful point at which Platé says, well, is Cupid not here? Is L'amour not here to bless the wedding? And Momus, who is the god of comedy, shows up as Cupid, and he wishes her ill health, no love, and the whole thing is perverted. Three characters come on and dance as the Three Graces, again a parody. Throughout this entire sequence, it's a parody of what they would have been used to. But they must have loved it, as actually, I suppose, as we speak, the opera Candide of Leonard Bernstein, which has always kept up with the times in terms of satire and political content, was a big controversy. The French loved it at the Théâtre du Châtelet, but La Scala didn't want to put on this parody of Berlusconi and Bush and Blair and all of these people who were included. So opera has always done this, I think. It's taken the very serious, including itself. Opera's good at laughing at itself. Mozart does this. He does it in Così fan tutte, which we'll talk about. But in this piece, it's very, to us, very obvious. Though at the time, I think they enjoyed it for what it was, and the parody got by. It was just a fun piece. We could play a little bit, perhaps, of the arrival of Jupiter to get a sense of how the great god arrives.
That a dance number?
No, it ends up in a dance. Everything ends in a dance in this. He will not arrive from the heavens because of our theater. Well, I don't know. We do amazing things at Santa Fe, but we have the real heavens. We don't have that fly space that most
right.
theaters have. So he arrives, and this is he's talking to Platé. He's wooing her, actually. Let me see if I can find those words and give you a sense of what he says. He arrives with thunder and lightning, and she's pretty taken aback by all of this. He says, "Oh, delightful object of my most worthy passions, be not any longer cast into doubt. Be reliant on my assistance. See, I free my hands of the dread thunder. I come no more to create trouble in your breast. Jupiter has become with you more touching and will seek naught else than to feel the pleasures of love." Now, you can hear in the way he sings this that he's not singing it sincerely. And Platé is speechless for once. The only word she can come out with is oof, which is not exactly high French.
Frog noise.
Yeah, frog noise, exactly. So you'll hear that. The music is just on the harpsichord here. They accompany the dialogue, which we call a recitative, a recitation, the talking part. This is not an aria where he's telling her how he feels, really. It's a conversational section. But you will hear his arrival with thunder and lightning and then into Jupiter's approach to Platé.
Terrible, indignes amours, ne soyez pas plus longtemps abusés. Comptez, comptez sur mon secours. Comptez, comptez sur mon secours. S'éloigne de mes mains la poudre coupable. Je ne viens point vous alarmer. Jupiter avec vous, devenu plus traitable, ne s'occupera plus que du plaisir d'aimer. Ne s'occupera plus que du plaisir d'aimer. Seriez-vous insensible à mes tendres feux? Je vous offre des vœux constants. Vous ne répondez rien.
Pardonnez-moi, j'étouffe et je soupire en même temps.
En attendant qu'un doux hymen s'apprête, qu'on réjouisse ici la nouvelle conquête. Moluse, rassemblez tous vos jeux, que l'allégresse de la fête égare l'excès de mes feux, égare l'excès de mes feux.
So that was the arrival of Jupiter in from Platé, Jean-Philippe Rameau's opera, which is going to be here this summer at the Santa Fe Opera, which is going to be something fun.
We're talking to Desiree Mays, and I will not let you get away with not talking about your own career. You have a long career as a dancer behind you and a dancer for the opera.
Well, yes, from the age of as early as I can remember, I wanted to be a dancer. My mother had been a dancer when it was not sort of, it was not really acceptable. When she trained as a dancer, but when a fiancé came along, she was made quite clear to her she could not have a career. That was it. So then I showed up and I wanted to dance. So I was very fortunate. In Ireland, we were taken to the opera, the ballet, and the symphony from the earliest days. My sister became a violinist in the Irish Symphony, and my younger sister was an actress. So we all went into the business, and I so loved dance that I was sent from my convent school, where the nuns did not approve of my prancing around all the time, to a boarding school in England, actually, to study, where we did nothing but study. Well, that's not true. Half of the day was spent in academic subjects and the other half in theatre and dance. And I was very fortunate when I graduated, studied in London, to be accepted into Festival Ballet, which was the probably the number two company to the Royal Ballet. I didn't have the cookie cutter shape to be a royal ballet dancer. I wasn't tall enough. So I danced with Festival, which was great. And this was a time in dance where, there had always been that terrible division between classical dance and modern dance, and never the twain shall meet. You loved one and hated the other. I mean, this was absolutely true. And it's only in recent years, I suppose, that that has changed, thanks to people like Baryshnikov, who have shown that it's okay to straddle the two worlds. Ballet West is another incredible example of classically trained dancers who are incredible modern dancers, too. So this was a transition time, but when I was dancing, it was all Swans and Swan Lake and Giselle and the great classics. And I also worked with Sadler's Wells Opera Ballet, which was wonderful. It wasn't. It turns out in opera, especially in England, the opera was the thing. The ballet was a sort of an auxiliary, a subsidiary thing. There was music for the ballet. And the ballet would often be included. But if they were running too long on time or interfered with the sets, the ballet would be cut. So often we were cut. And as years have gone by, in fact, the ballet has been cut more and more and more in Europe. It's really a shame.
From the opera.
From the operas. You don't often see it. Right down to the last time I saw Eugène Onegin, the third act opens with an incredible polonaise. That's, to me, the high point of the opera, the Russian court dancing the polonaise. And the last time I saw it, it was completely cut. They played the music and did something else, but no dancers. Now, again, as I said, this was never true of French opera. The French have always treasured their dance, and you get great dance sequences. Often that has nothing to do with the piece in hand. Carmen is a good example. Third act, near the end, there is this wonderful dance sequence where they stop the story. Dance tends to stop the story a bit because then it takes over and does something else. But in these early days, in fact, you'd often get an act of music and song, and then you'd get a completely separate dance sequence, a ballet, and then back to the opera and a ballet. It could go on for 6-7 hours. These things were long. But in my experience, yes, it was wonderful to be a dancer in the opera. I fell in love with opera from an early age. And then when I came to this country, married and had kids and hung up my pointe shoes and found that my Irish voice could talk and I still wanted to stay in touch with it, then this whole thing of storytelling, of telling the stories of operas and giving background, I mean, I fell in love with the whole genre. And it was a long apprenticeship, I suppose. My married life started in Utah the Utah Opera was starting, a wonderful company. So I did all of the punch and cookie deals but then from there started my own radio show and bringing in speakers and eventually speaking myself. So when I came here, I was really thrilled when the Santa Fe Opera invited me to be their lecturer. So I've lectured now up there for, this will be the 10th, 11th year every night at the opera. I tell the story and it's been wonderful.
Now in the opera Platé, you really can't cut the dance numbers because they're integral to the story.
No, absolutely not. You wouldn't be left with much. And in the production that people will see this summer, we have two incredible people, Laurent Pelly, who, if people saw La Belle Hélène or Cinderella last year, know that this Frenchman has an extraordinary, wonderful edge to his humor that makes it very appealing. I mean, you come out laughing, singing, it's great. And with him is Laura Scozzi. She is the choreographer who has a very stylized, wonderful, again, sense of humor. These dancers have a sense of humor. And Rameau was great. When Rameau wrote music for dancers, he made it very explicit in the music what he was trying to achieve, what mood or emotion. And so for a choreographer, it was a gift. I mean, he virtually spells out what they need to be doing. So the production we will have will be modeled on the Parisian production, which should be wonderful. And our dancers are coming in from New York, I understand. They just had auditions for that, and they'll be coming in. So dance is a major part of this. But again, it's a sort of a send-up version. Maybe we could play one of those happy dances from Platé, the dance sequence where the chorus are singing in praise of Bacchus and they dance. It's a contredanse. And that was a little dance sequence from Platé by Jean-Philippe Rameau, which will be at the Santa Fe Opera this summer. I hope everyone can come.
And the time has flown by as usual. Desiree Mays, I'd like to thank you so much for being with us here. Desiree Mays is the author of Opera Unveiled, which is a book that accompanies the Santa Fe Opera every summer. And the Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org. Is that right?
Yes.
And you are also lecturing.
Yes, every night at the Preview Buffet. I'll be telling a little of the story, giving a little background on each of the operas. So if people want to do that, they should contact the opera company for tickets.
Desiree, thanks so much.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams on the web live at ksfr.org. And this show is podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz. Once again, for more information and tickets, call the Santa Fe Opera box office at 986-5900 or go online at santafeopera.org. Thank you.